So now we are going into beyond RCBD as a design versus model based.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. My name is Peter Clausen, and when I am not busy organizing scientific meetings, I have a side job writing software for Gilling Data Management. You might have heard of us. What I do is we get requests from clients for new features, and there is a process I go through to try to find the pros and cons of different types of analysis. So today I'm going to share with you some of the design-based versus model-based approaches to dealing with special heterogeneity. And what I mean by beyond RCBD is we are going to look at statistical models for analysis beyond the randomized complete block model. And we're going to look at the design-based approaches beyond the randomized complete block design. So I'm a motivating example. You know, if you don't mind, I have been sitting still for way too long this week. I am going to give myself a little freedom. So we are talking about a paper from 1947 as a motivating example. The title is Some Consequences When the Assumptions for the Analysis of Variance Are Not Satisfied by William Cochran. And it is under section 7, Effects of Correlation Amongst the Errors. Occasionally, it may be discovered that the data have been subject to some systematic pattern of environmental variation that the randomization has been unable to cope with. If the environmental pattern obviously masks the treatment effect, resort may be had to what might be called desperate remedies in order to salvage some information. I quoted this because I can't think of a better way to state the problem. And in this case, he gives an experiment of a randomized complete doc design, a 2x4 factorial experiment in two replicates. So it's 16 treatments in two squares of four. And for any one treatment, any one factor, there's sufficient replication. But to look at the overall treatment structure, we have a really limited blocking aspect. And this is actually different applications of different fertilizers. The yield map, and we're going to be looking at these, we see low-yielding areas and high-yielding areas, and this is just Perithium diheadweight, and there is a definite clear pattern in the middle of the field. And Cochran again, it is evident that the first row of plots is of poor fertility. Treatments appearing in that row have only about half the yields that they give elsewhere. Further, there are indications that every row differs in fertility, the last row being the second worst and the third row being the best. The fertility gradients are especially troublesome in that the four untreated controls all happen to lie in outside rows. The two replications give practically identical totals and remove none of the variation. And we would see that when we look at the analysis of variance. The replicate mean squares is very small. And in this case, we might not even analyze as an RCB design because we get better residual error. We get a smaller residual error and more degrees of freedom if we analyze as a CRD. And this is actually a modeling-based approach to analysis, where we discard that our design model is adequate for our analysis. And in fact, actually, we can argue that the design model is inappropriate. And I'm not going to bore you with a lot of math. I did throw a couple graphs up here, but it's Wednesday, and I'm not going to do that to you people. It is not a mathematically plausible model, because it gives us a variance estimate that's negative. So we would have a basis for rejecting that model. And so Cochran again, there is clearly little hope of obtaining information about the treatment effects unless weights are adjusted for differences in fertility from row to row. The adjustment may be made by covariance. If it were desired to adjust separately for every row, a multiple covariance with four X variables could be computed. It will be realized that the covariance technique, if misused, can lead to underestimation of errors. It is, however, worth keeping in mind as an occasional weapon for difficult uses. An occasional weapon for difficult uses. Where are my letters? And this is a common problem. We run analysis and there's nothing there. And the response we like to get is you might have been met better mean separation if you use a different experimental layout next time. That is to say that we can offer a design-based approach to account for spatial heterogeneity. But I want letters now. We don't really have these guys. Come on, don't laugh at that. It's not that funny, is it, Sharon? We don't actually have these conversations with our clients. But I'm going to blame Tom Morris for this. He put into the adult education component of his lecture on Monday that we try to put surprises into our conversations, and this is a little bit of a surprise. But it is to say that when we get these questions as statisticians, is there a model that we can use to give us some better inferences? So Cochrane's occasional weapon for difficult uses is a rudimentary form of spatial analysis. He's talking about inferring a spatially variant covariate based on the row mean. And there are many other methods for this. We're going to talk about two general classes. And in spatial analysis, one of the problems with spatial variability is it tends to be different on different scales. It's fractal. And so there's a lot of different ways you can break out spatial variation. So we're going to look at two extremes. We're going to look at a local we're going to look at global pattern identification and local pattern identification. More specifically, we're going to use trend analysis as a way of identifying some smoothly varying trend over the entire field. Or we're going to use local nearest neighbor analysis and only look at what neighboring plots contribute to spatial heterogeneity. And so trend analysis, and it's really, I'm going to illustrate trend analysis in one dimension, but we really do it in two dimensions simultaneously. There are ways of doing trend analysis within rows and for different rows in the treatment. So we're just going to look at row number 3 where we find the most yield. And we see that we can interpolate the treatment residuals in this case. And I should emphasize that when we do this modeling, we throw out anything else, but we're looking for deviations from treatment means. And so we're going to be looking at residuals from the treatment means. And as we increase the polynomial, we go from the row mean, which was Cochrane's suggestion, to a linear trend, to a quadratic trend, to a cubic trend, and that we have a cubed value in there, we start to approximate what we think might be the spatial variation. And now the other one is nearest neighbor analysis, and the difficulty I run into is there is not one nearest neighbor analysis. Papadakis is most associated with that, and his method is actually combining both row and column means, the nearest neighbors. But there are going to be times when either a column neighbor might be best, or a row neighbor might be best, or it might be best to split them out. We don't do field experiments in square shapes. We have rectangular plots, we have spacing between rows, we have spacing between columns. It doesn't always make sense to have our row columns, our row neighbors and our column neighbors treated equally. So when we get to modeling, we need to be able to choose those. So a little bit about the mathematics of the nearest row neighbors, just to illustrate that. As we get the treatment residuals, we find treatment pairs on either side of a plot, and then we try to use that as a covariate. And at the bottom, we can see that that covariate that we're getting from the neighbor means is a smoothing effect. It does kind of follow a trend, but it's a local estimate, and it means it tends to follow the data more. So we have two options, is we throw something over the entire field, or we are guided by what happened in small places. And then we have the other option, which is a different experimental layout next time. And here in our example, we saw that the spatial variability was too large to be captured by our blocking units. And we can improve this by breaking up our blocks into smaller, incomplete block designs. The most common ones are going to be square lattices, which are blocked in one dimension, or lattice squares, which are blocked in two dimensions. And again, our incomplete block, we have our whole block, which is basically a square of 4, and we could conceivably divide it up into an incomplete block of 4 plots. But we can't just do that, because we have to design for incomplete blocks. And I'll just jump ahead and illustrate this. If we look at the Cochrane example and we look at treatment number 15, well, let's presume treatment number 15 is a high-yielding treatment. This is one that got all the combinations of fertilizer, so we might expect it to be high-yielding. It appears twice in the same block with treatment 12 and treatment 5. When we estimate block effects, we are going to average over 4 treatments in a block, and if treatment 15 is large, we are going to estimate a large block effect, which means treatment 5 is going to be underestimated, or could very well be underestimated. So we have confounding with this, and we have an unbalanced confounding. When we go to incomplete block designs, we rearrange our treatment so they appear 0 or 1 times together in the same blocks. This allows us, using randomization theory, to account for that sampling difference in our incomplete blocks. So we have to plan ahead. We can't just go back and try to model. So this is the dilemma we have. We are faced with, can we do something with this analysis if we use randomization theory to guide us, we can make some statements about cause and effect because we have exchangeability in plots, but we might not have any significance to actually say anything. Or we can be tempted to find a spatial model for this experiment. We lose some of our cause and effect because we no longer control our treatment structure. But we can't explain what did happen, at least this time. And so that leads us to a model selection problem. All right. The original design may not be the best model, but it will be an appropriate model. When we attach ourselves from design, now we have to find out if we pick a model that may be biased. And this is the model selection problem. We have the trade-off between bias, which is underfitting the model, and it is where we have fewer parameters, we have more bias. And we have more parameters, we end up getting discrepancy from what the actual event was. And we'll illustrate this. Oops, sorry. And it's the principle of parsimony. I think I said that right, parsimony. I always want to say parsimony and just screw it all up. And it's all comes razor. Entities are not to be multiplied without necessity. As we go down and increase the polynomials on the left side, we go from a linear, just a row mean, which is biased. I think it underestimates yield in one part of the field and overestimates yield in a different part. As we increase the number of polynomials, we see we reduce that bias. We get closer to what probably really happened. But we keep adding, and now we have a second hot spot, a second high yielding spot. And as we add enough polynomials, it tells us that if we had put a plot between column 7 and column 8, it would have been much higher yielding than anything we saw. And that's our discrepancy in the model. So we have to find that balance. Well, the guidance we use is called an information criteria. And Aki Ike did this a long time ago, where he looked at the idea that when we model a linear model, we select the maximum likelihood estimates. And this is Fisher's likelihood theory. And there's a relationship between a log likelihood function and what's called a Kubler-Leibach information number. And again, I'm not going to give you a lot of math. I had 3 or 4 slides to justify this, and I just couldn't do it. I keep threatening to put on my business card that I talk to statisticians so you don't have to. So I'm going to make the math. You'll have to trust me that the math is right here, okay? We simplify Ike's information criteria to be a function proportional to number of parameters k, and the log function of the residual sums of squares times the number of observations. And we think of the AIC, and we'll talk about BEC, as a badness of fit measure. Okay, a less bad number reduces residual sums of squares. This is our intuition. Right? We want our residual error to become smaller. But if we do this at the expense of adding parameters, our AIC goes up and it's a more bad fit. So our balance between goodness of fit, or excuse me, variance and the bias is one tool we use to find that balance. It's not the only tool. There are other AIC measures. We'll look at BIC, which weights a little differently on the number of parameters. And there are a couple others that I won't go into. We'll probably be exploring more. So here's some actual model comparison for the Cochrane and Cox data, or the Cochrane data from 1947. And our intuition here is that we go from a randomized complete block design to a CRD design, and we do reduce the residual sums of squares, residual mean squares. We get an improvement on the AIC and the BIC. It also gives us some guidance if we want to use a neighbor model. Well, neighbor models, most neighbor models improve upon CRD, but it's the neighbor models that have the row effects and ignore column neighbors. And so the GIST is an idea of if there is a local spatial variation, we can start to decide how to choose that. But we really get the most improvement from a cubic trend model. Good. Letters. Yay. But we have to have some caveats. The AIC and BIC are not test statistics. We can't really assign them a p-value. In fact, we really can't say a lot about them other than it's better or worse. One's better than the other. The trouble is you can have a garbage model that is better than another garbage model, still a garbage model. And I'm saying garbage because we're in a polite society. You know what I'm thinking. So we also have to have some guidance about whether or not. And so one of the things I do is we try to visualize the fertility. Is given our best fit model, let's assume we had planned only one treatment. What does the model predict for yield? And so if we go to our original yield and then our cubic trend model, we have to apply, and the point I want to make is, we have to apply some intuition and judgment about whether or not we've got the right model. We can't just type in some SAS codes or hit an R script or punch a button on a piece of software and get P values and say, yep, good, we're ready to go. Okay, there is modeling is going to take some extra thought. So some simulations we did, or I did with this same experimental layout, and we're using a uniformity trial based on the Cochrane plan and the square lattice based on the same design structure. Now what I do for simulation is I like to take yield monitor data, because again, spatial variation is fractal. And I don't want to try to simulate using normal standard populations and random draws like we would normally simulate. I like to overlay it on something that I believe matches field structure. And then we simulate a trial plan and estimate what the yield would have been in the plot had we done that experiment as a uniform experiment, in this case a field of corn. In this case we get 140 simulated trial. And this helps us understand what kind of model selection we get with different criteria. Now, when we have the design RCB, we're almost always going to get a cubic trend model being the best model. And particularly two replicate RCB, it's going to be very easy to throw that out. When we do it as a lattice, we're still going to get a trend model as a better model, but we're more likely, in this case, to keep our original design. And what we also see is by blocking the treatments in a smaller scale, we might find that it's the local interactions that change our results and not the global interaction. So we have maybe a little better understanding of what actually happened and can detect what actually happened in the field if we plan for it. Another simulation I'll cover real briefly is from Cochrane and Cox, and this is their lattice square design, which means it's blocked in both row and columns. And there is a couple publications, some in the Agronomy Journal, that have codes in SAS for doing the analysis of this. So it's a 25 treatment, 3 replicate, 5x5 grid. And I don't have that. Well, my field disappeared. We overlaid this against simulated and got 60 trials. Or no, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. In the model itself, and this is just the analysis from the data set, in this case, row column lattice matches our intuition. It's the smallest residual mean square. And AIC prefers this model. But BIC likes a small, and I'm anthropomorphic, BIC isn't really a person, doesn't like anything. But in this case, it does like the row neighbor. It likes a simpler model. So if we use BRC, we would reject our original design. And again, we simulate this over several experiments, and we get 60 trials over this field. And for the most part, BIC likes the simpler models. AIC and RMS give us the design model back. And there is some difference between AIC and RMS, residual mean square. I tend to like AIC because it does give us some meaning about the number of parameters. And finally, we're going to finish up with an example, and this actually comes from some of Amir's data with the SGSU winter wheat variety trials, where we are doing the same experiment, the same treatment structure, and the same field structure over multiple locations. And all I did with this is I looked at two of the outcomes, test weight and yield, over 6-7 locations and 4 years. And I'm not even looking at whether it's a nearest neighbor row, nearest neighbor column, if it's a cubic trend or polynomial trend. It's whether we want the local model or a global model or the design model. And there is no real agreement here on which of those three is the best overall. So once we go to modeling, now we have to decide if we want to combine trials that we can find the same model that is suitable for all trials or for all assessments for all years. There is an appropriate model for all of these, right? And that's the RCB. That's what we designed for. So we want to, and my kind of final thought on this is we have this tool that helps us understand what happens in an experiment and may help us guide us in future selection. And it's real tempting to use it because we get letters. But we can't necessarily extend that beyond that experiment. And so if you want to plan, and planning requires, well, it requires planning if you want to be able to combine experiments. And I think I'm coming pretty close to my time, so I thank you, and there are my references. One last thing I want to add, I am a believer in repeatability and transparency, and so a lot of the codes that I use to create these slides will be available for download from our website, SAS and R, if you want to play around with my ideas and make sure I got them right. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
have a time for maybe one or two quick questions before we move on. Yes, please.
Yes.
So, in the new paradigms that we're looking about, and I'm using them,
yeah,
are very much based on the point of just living in the field of the sampling.
Yeah.
Where is sample representativity talked about?
Sample?
So representativity. Because sometimes you are taking the sample in the wrong place and you fall.
That's the idea of sample representativity, and maybe my understanding it is, part of it is that when we talk about the randomization theory and p-values, right, we're talking about, is our p-value associated with our estimate of what happened? Is our p-value estimate of what might have happened under different conditions? Are we, or if we were to repeat the treatment structure, make inferences about the cause and effect relationships, is there our p-value related to whether it'll happen again in the future? And that is beyond this, because that's where you make your choices about where to do the experiment and under what conditions you can extend it. So in this case, I'm really only talking about trying to find a model that explains what happened in one experiment and whether or not you want to choose that model. And then it comes to, making further, then it gets a little tougher.
So we go to the old fresh intro now.
Part of it is, and this is the thing, is sometimes, the dilemma is you spent a year in a field, a growing season, you saw things happen, you run an analysis, and nothing happened. Do you say, okay, I'll try it again, and maybe I'll get better luck next time? Or you say, well, what can I model now and help me understand? I can't tell you right or wrong on that. I can only try to give you some pros and cons. I'm going to have to cut myself off. Too.
Yes,
so
I will cut you off or actually try to finish up. I would like to thank all the four speakers. Okay. It's not able to actually hold the weight anymore.
I broke it. Sorry.
Yeah, no. Thank you all the speakers. Again, give a clap.